I have enjoyed for quite a long time the engagement with my peers and my colleagues. When I got involved in organized medicine, I went out of curiosity when I was a second year medical student. So this was November of 1995 to the AMA's interim meeting, and it was in Washington, D.C. that particular year. And when I went there, I found it fascinating, just the complexity of the policymaking that was done, but I found it even more enjoyable to meet all these people from all over the nation. So there were physicians of, at that time I was with medical students, but of all specialty interests of from all the states. And you know, where else can I meet as an emergency physician, surgeons and radiologists and pediatricians and you know, infectious disease doctors, GI docs from all over the country who have different hobbies and interests. And we're coming together not because we're in the same medical staff or group practice just caring for patients. We're coming together because we have interests in policy and are trying to improve public policy in order to benefit our patients and to support the profession that serves them. And so I found that fascinating and I kept going back. So I went out of curiosity, but I kept coming back because I just thoroughly enjoyed that engagement with my peers and colleagues. And over a multi-decade period of time, I had plenty of leadership development opportunities there. I had lots of mentorship that I benefited from people senior to me, and then later on, people who were my peers. And I learned just a whole lot of stuff. And in fact, I would not have been able to do the way I did it, the Commissioner for Public Health position.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Welcome to episode 18 of Pemba On Demand. Today, I'm pleased to have as my guest, Dr. Stephen Stack, MD, MBA, discussing transforming healthcare, a physician's perspective on public health policy. Stephen is an alumnus of the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, class of 2017. Dr. Stack received his medical degree from The Ohio State University in 1998, and he also completed his emergency medicine residency at The Ohio State University as well. Stephen then worked for Team Health for nearly 20 years, not only as a staff physician, but also holding several leadership roles in the organization. While continuing to practice as an emergency medicine physician, Stephen also joined the Board of Trustees of the AMA in 2006. Between 2014 and 2017, Stephen was the president of the American Medical Association, being the first emergency physician to ever serve in that capacity. During his career, he developed an interest in information technology, also serving on the Health IT Federal Advisory Committee for over 6 years. He's been active in many other roles during his career. He currently is also an adjunct professor for the Haslam College of Business at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. I'm very excited to have Stephen on the show. I think that he's going to bring a very interesting perspective to us today. And I'm excited that you have the opportunity to join us for this episode. Well, hello again, everyone. And as I said before, I'm excited to have Dr. Stack join us for this episode. Stephen, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Norm.
Well, it's really nice to have you here. I'm excited that we have this opportunity to chat for a little while and to share some of your background and experiences with the fellow Pemba alumni listening and other members of the audience as well.
Looking forward to it.
So I'd like to start today by just kind of having you talk a little bit about your current role. You're the Commissioner for Public Health for the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and you've been in that role now for a little over 4 years. I just wonder if you could kind of share with us a little bit about what a day in the life of the Commissioner for Public Health is like.
Well, sure. So a day in the life of the commissioner now is more typical than it was during COVID. So I started February of 2020, which was just 1 month before COVID really came in full force. And during the COVID years, life was very unusual. I played obviously a central role in advising the governor and the executive branch in interventions and actions that were taken during the pandemic. That was consuming. It was unrelenting. It was the hardest single professional thing I've ever done. And that includes residency and internship and 20-year career as a clinical emergency physician. The more recent 2 years have been more traditional public health commissioner role, where I oversee an agency that is about $500 million a year of activity with approximately 150 different programs. I have a little over 700 direct employees in my agency, and then we have over 3,500 employees in 61 different local health departments across the state that support 120 counties. So there's a lot of complexity day in and day out. There's the management responsibility of leading a team and overseeing that activity. And then there's the complexities and challenges that would happen in any complex business. In this case, it's a public sector operation, addressing major challenges, opportunities, hurdles that go along with running complicated programs that are often state, federal, and local government partnership programs and have a heavy interaction with the private sector and individual clinicians and or patients. So my daily job looks a lot like a CEO in a public sector enterprise at present, which is rich and rewarding and also full of opportunities and challenges.
So what led to the opportunity for you to assume this role? I know it's an appointed role, as you said, by the governor. How did you express an interest in that, or how did this opportunity come about?
Sure. So the backstory is I spent 20 years of my career advocating to government and professional medical associations. And along the way, I spent a lot of time telling government officials what I thought they were doing incorrect and what I thought they should be doing differently or better. And along the way, it occurred to me that I'd like to know what it was like to be the other person on the other side of the desk and what their constraints and limitations are and what their opportunities might be. And so in 2019, the current governor was elected, and there was a change of administrations. And whenever that occurs, new governors often build a brand new team above a certain level, and commissioners are typically that level and up. And there was an opportunity for a new public health commissioner. And people who knew me, I think, recommended me to the process. And I said I was open to the opportunity. I had an interview with the governor-elect and then an interview with the cabinet secretary, who's actually my direct boss. And I was offered the opportunity in January of 2020. And at the time, it was a leap of faith. My wife said, are you sure you want to do a government sector job because you're open to public scrutiny? And I said, nobody knows who the public health commissioner is. And then a month later, COVID happened, and I was on television every single day with my governor, and everybody knew who the health commissioner was. So life deals you a twist every now and then. But it's been a privilege. I'm forever grateful for it, and I feel really honored to have had this opportunity. And I don't look back. I do it all over again.
What was the biggest takeaway from you from being on the side where you're lobbying, in a sense, for physicians from the AMA's perspective and just as a practicing physician and dealing with government as a practicing physician or as a representative of physicians? What was the biggest surprise to you or the biggest takeaway about being on the other side of that equation, as you said?
I don't know if I'd say it's as much surprise as much as just a much more deep and real understanding of the challenges. So it's difficult for people in roles like mine in our communication to have candid moments and be overt about the challenges and the frustrations, because things can be taken out of context, misconstrued. They can be sincerely misunderstood or intentionally distorted. And so then things get very, very hard. Difficult conversations become impossible conversations. So I think what you find is because communication can be so difficult, and lots of folks have difficulty with conflict resolution and also with how to be forthright and open without somehow also saying things that cause problems. A lot of conversations that need to occur probably don't occur as deeply and meaningfully as they need to. Other things are there are real limitations in government. So In order to safeguard against abuse of public resources, there are processes in place to try to prevent against fraud, abuse, policymaking that advantages unfairly one part of society at the expense of another. But those safeguards make it also very difficult to do things that in the private sector you take for granted. If I want to purchase something that's off the shelf, like Microsoft Office, you know, or I can go and buy that just off the marketplace because anyone can buy that. If, however, I need to contract for a certain service and only for-profit companies provide those services, I have to do a competitive procurement. I have to describe in explicit detail what it is I seek. I have to post that and make it available to any public provider who wants to provide it. Then you have to score all the proposals you receive and then pick the vendor to work with. But there's a very prescribed process, which makes it very difficult sometimes to get to the outcome you seek or you desire. Those are real challenges, but they're also there because there have been plenty of times, I'm sure, over history where government officials steered or directed business to people who are friends or family or others for inappropriate reasons. Similarly, the state employment process has, for good reason, protections in place for career civil servants so they don't become subject to the politics of changing administrations and can do their work on behalf of the people they serve. Those protections also, though, make it very difficult to hire in a quick way and also make it difficult to part ways with certain employees if they're not working out well because of the protections in place. So those challenges, those difficulties are real. There are legitimate reasons why those are there as safeguards against bad behaviors, but they also make it hard for me to be nimble and flexible and move quickly. And those are real challenges. And it's frustrating when you're trying to talk with private sector partners, why can't we make certain changes? Well, I may agree with you and be as frustrated as you are about my inability to do certain things, but there are real constraints that I have to face in my role. So I think I have a much deeper and better understanding of how that works. And I think, therefore, I hope I'm more effective in my role as a government official, but also someday when I return to the private sector, will hopefully be more effective as an advocate for interests because I will hopefully be able to better place myself in the position of the government officials with whom I'm engaging and try to propose plans of action that address both their constraints and their needs, as well as those that you know, serve the purposes of the group that I'm part of.
So it's interesting that you talk about the issues that you've learned being on the government side. Have you had the opportunity to try to explain some of those challenges to physicians who are formerly your colleagues or still your colleagues, I guess, who remain in the private sector?
I have, but I'll give you a different example. So I administer a number of programs, or at least my agency does. And we have a number of different arrangements with clinicians and providers. I don't like the term, by the way, providers. I think it is, I don't know if demeaning is the right word, but it's diminishing. Let's say that. It's diminishing of the unique human role that clinicians play in patients' lives. So I don't like that sanitized word, providers. But I have to use it sometimes because it's a more, it encapsulates more richly or accurately the variety of different people providing services. So with that little segue, I have programs that have clinicians in them, and we have to administer complicated federal-state partnership programs and pay whatever rates we can. And I empathize. I don't just empathize. I sympathize with the frustrations they have, that compensation rates have not kept up with inflation, that the requirements of the programs are difficult and complicated at times. And yet I have real constraints. I can't just do what I want to do. I have to follow real rules, federal and state, in implementing these programs. And so I have had plenty of opportunities now to explain to folks and try to help them understand, here's how the system operates. Here's the constraints I face. Here are how things work. And then try to find commonality where we can work together to advance objectives that support the people we serve, the programs themselves, and then the people in the programs who are providing the services. And so I hope I've had some degree of success with that. I've said with folks, I think this is an essential part of effective dialogue and conflict resolution, that sometimes in my role, I can say yes. Sometimes I have to say no. Sometimes I say, I don't know. Let me get back to you. But I can always do it with kindness and courtesy and with decorum and respect. And I think that I learned this in spades when I was in emergency medicine, and I see it in public affairs. People can generally appreciate. They don't have to have lots of advanced education. They can appreciate when you are treating them with respect and courtesy versus when you are talking down to them or demeaning them or being disrespectful. And a little courtesy goes a long way. And so I have actually found, though it sounds simplistic, just being a decent human being and being kind to others goes a very long way to trying to find partnership and commonality. And so, yes, I've had plenty of opportunity to explain those, you know, how things work, to share frustration, and yet still do my job, which is to, you know, support the policies of the administration for which I work and try to advance these public programs that support a lot of people in our state who need their services.
What percentage of your role on a daily basis or weekly basis is focused on issues specific to Kentucky, and what percentage of your role is focused on larger advocacy responsibilities with the federal government or with consortiums of states that deal with Medicaid programs and those other types of issues?
Boy, you know, I haven't really thought about a breakdown that way, but I do both of those, and I do both of those on a regular basis. So as a state official, I know we regulate restaurants, food manufacturing, septic systems, public swimming pools, variety of other things. And so those are internal to the state. And so we have state regulations where we promulgate the rules that govern them. And we have the workforce who has to go out and provide the inspections and the enforcement. And so that is solidly a state level activity. But then my agency is responsible for overseeing the WIC program, the Women, Infant, and Children program, which is a food, nutrition, educational, and benefit program. Also a program called Kentucky Early Intervention Services, which is a partnership with the Department of Education at the federal level, where we provide therapists who go into the home for parents with children aged 0 to 3 who have disabilities and try to improve the parents' caregiving capacity to do a better job for their kids. So I have to engage. We also have the Ryan White program, the federal Ryan White program, which is part of HRSA, which I believe is the Healthcare Resources and Service Administration at the federal level. And that program provides care and services for people living with HIV or AIDS. And I have to interact with people at the federal level. I have to be accountable to them for the grants that we receive and the deliverables we're required to provide. I also have to advocate to them at times when I think that their implementation or oversight of the program in our state is either perhaps not consistent with what appears to be the real federal requirements or challenging for us and when we need to do things a little bit differently. So I have local health departments and other partners who are the ones who actually do a lot of this work, actually with the patients or the frontline citizens. So I like the state level because I have to work both up to the federal level, across at the state level, and then down to the local level and navigate all three of those layers of government, which for me is just a really rich complexity, which makes my job difficult in many ways, frustrating on some days, but undeniably engaging, rewarding, and fulfilling.
It's interesting that you bring up all of those different areas. I think a lot of us don't realize that those fall under the purview of the Commissioner for Public Health. And as I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking more about it from the perspective of how your office would interact with healthcare organizations and physicians more so than all of those other areas. So that's kind of an interesting perspective that I hadn't really considered as I was preparing for the talk. What is the role of the Commissioner for Public Health in dealing with hospitals and healthcare organizations, payers, as well as the direct frontline providers?
Sure. So it varies from state to state. So the same titles don't have the same responsibilities if you cross the 50 states, DC, and the territories like Puerto Rico and others. So I, as a commissioner for public health, have a scope of responsibility over certain programs, but I am two levels down from the governor. So there's a secretary between me and the governor, and I work for, at the pleasure of both, but I work for the secretary in my daily life. My secretary has underneath him numerous things, but they include Department for Public Health, Medicaid, Department for Community-Based Services, which includes social workers and does all sorts of custody issues, Department for Behavioral, Developmental, and Intellectual Disabilities, mm-hmm. and also a Department for Aging and Independent Living. And the five of us are the biggest agencies, and we each are commissioners. So he has five commissioners for five large agencies. And it's probably close to $22 billion a year of activity that's in that this one cabinet. If you were to go to a different state, though, someone with the same title as me, Commissioner for Public Health, may in fact be the equivalent of a secretary and report directly to the governor. So the titles are not all the same. And many of our agencies do not have Medicaid within them, but Medicaid either is a sister agency or even in an entirely different cabinet. And that changes the dynamic substantially. So there's a lot of variation from across the country how that all works. But in my day-to-day life, I mean, it's an enormous swath of things that I'm involved in that impact hundreds of thousands of people, I would say, on a continual and regular basis in the state.
Thank you for sharing that structure with me, because I didn't realize there were five different commissioners in the way your state was organized. And it's interesting, as I think about Michigan, I honestly couldn't tell you right now, although it's given me food for thought to try to understand better the structure of my own state in terms of how that's all coming up under the Department of Health and Human Services in Michigan.
I would share with you, though, that each state has someone who is designated as the state health official. Mm-hmm. It varies how that happens. In some states, it becomes the chief medical officer for the state. In others, it's the commissioner for public health, like it is for me. In some others, it may be the secretary for health and human services. But there's one identified person as the state health official for the states. And then you had mentioned how I'm engaged in other organizations and various roles. I'm currently the president of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. And so that's a group of 50 state health officials, the District of Columbia, and then there are eight others who are either are the territories of the United States, like Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, and a couple others, or independently affiliated island nations like Palau or Guam, I mm-hmm. think. So there are 59 of us in total. And that group really is the equivalent of this state-level leadership in all of public health for the nation. And so when we get together, you really have that layer that is essential to the federal government being able to effectuate its programs through state and local government, because virtually everything, not everything, but virtually everything that the federal government does is funded by and organized by the federal government, but ultimately fulfilled through either a state or a local government or some other vendor.
So that particular organization, and how long have you been in a leadership role in that organization?
It's a one-year term as president, but I became the secretary treasurer in the fall of 2020. And so it's been about, 4.5 years almost. This fall, it'll be 5 years that I've been in a leadership role.
So that was, again, right during the COVID pandemic in the fall of 2020.
Yeah, and I got that wrong. I can't count. It'll be 4 years this fall that I've been in a leadership role on the board.
Okay. So I don't remember hearing much about that organization as we went through COVID. Obviously, the CDC was front and center. CMS was front and center. And in our state, of course, I had many, many phone calls with state public health officials and local health departments. So what was the role of this organization in shaping the response to COVID?
So it provides a support service, if you will, for the state health officials and the departments we lead. So during COVID, we met on a biweekly basis. So I'm sorry, not biweekly. We met twice a week. Mm-hmm. So we met Tuesday and Friday. We'd have an hour-long meeting, and federal policymakers, federal officials would come and interact with us. So we have regular discussions with people who are, you know, the CDC director, leaders for other major federal agencies, who have programs or policies they need to implement and oversee. And they come there as a way to meet with us and share information and for us to collaborate. We, of course, offer comments and feedback as a group to the federal government and the agencies we work with. And the association, ASTO, also is a grant recipient itself to provide technical assistance to help promote the success of federal programs by helping to build capacity at state health departments. And so it plays a really valuable role. It was in the media, and there was news coverage for the activity we did from time to time. But while that's important to us to be able to have a voice, I think it's our primary focus to support the state health officials and the agencies they lead so that the state level of public health can do the work that it needs to do most effectively.
Okay. This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. I'd like to pivot a little bit. I know that you were a practicing emergency physician for nearly 20 years, worked with Team Health and began as a staff physician and then assumed leadership roles. And then in 2006, while you were still practicing, you joined the Board of Trustees of the American Medical Association. I'm kind of interested in, and you mentioned your advocacy from the standpoint of a practicing physician, but what was it about the healthcare environment or about the practice environment that really led to your passion and your interest in organized medicine?
I have enjoyed for quite a long time the engagement with my peers and my colleagues. When I got involved in organized medicine, I went out of curiosity when I was a second-year medical student. So this was November of 1995 to the AMA's interim meeting, and it was in Washington, D.C. that particular year. And when I went there, I found it fascinating, just the complexity of the policymaking that was done, but I found it even more enjoyable to meet all these people from all over the nation. So there were physicians at that time I was with medical students, but of all specialty interests from all the states. And, you know, where else can I meet as an emergency physician, surgeons and radiologists and pediatricians and, you know, infectious disease doctors, GI docs, from all over the country who have different hobbies and interests. And we're coming together not because we're in the same medical staff or group practice just caring for patients. We're coming together because we have interests in policy and are trying to improve public policy in order to benefit our patients and to support the profession that serves them. And so I found that fascinating, and I kept going back. So I went out of curiosity, but I kept coming back because I just thoroughly enjoyed that engagement with my peers and colleagues. And over a multi-decade period of time, I had plenty of leadership development opportunities there. I had lots of mentorship that I benefited from people senior to me, and then later on, people who were my peers. And I learned just a whole lot of stuff. And in fact, I would not have been able to do the way I did it, the commissioner for public health position, 1 month into my tenure and at the start of the biggest global pandemic in a century. I don't know how I would have overcome that or worked through that the way we did if I hadn't had all that experience in organized medicine, including being the president and the board chair for the AMA.
Yeah. So what was did you have a mentor when you were a medical student who really highlighted the opportunity for you, or was it just something you were naturally interested in that at that point in your career?
I thought about this. So the mentorship question is a good one, and it's a difficult one because it's sort of like we don't have enough time to go through the list of people who've been impactful mentors for me. And when I start this journey, I can't help but go all the way back to grade school my sixth grade science teacher, two sisters who got me into Toastmasters International for public speaking as an eighth grader, an elderly couple who I did yard work for years when I was in middle school and high school, who just, all of them have lessons that I learned that to this day, I attach specific lessons to those specific people and the journey I had. And I could go forward in time. It gets harder the older I get, and even as I went through medical school and beyond, to start to singularly pull out certain people, because I think I had such a rich experience at a younger age that I actively seek out those opportunities. And now that I'm in my 50s, it's become very difficult, because now it turns out that I'm the person who's the old guy in the room, not the young kid anymore. And people look to me for mentorship, which is a weird and jarring experience for all of us who go through this life journey of aging. But be that as it may, now it's more peer colleagues who offer useful feedback and insight, not people who I look to as an elder mentor at this stage. So there wasn't a singular person. I just enjoy the engagement. And what I have found is that these leadership positions I've had over the years, the vast majority of them were not with a long-term horizon. Like, I want to be the president of the AMA, so I will do these things to get there. It was, I'm a medical student, I'm enjoying myself here, and people said I should run for the speaker to, you know, preside over the section. And I did. And I ran, and I won, and I did it. And then I became a resident, and someone vacated a position for whatever reason, and they needed nominations from the floor. And so I, you know, was nominated from the floor, and I said, okay. And I did a leadership position. So one thing led to the next. And what ended up happening was, when you look back on history, it looks like, you know, I could tell a very tight narrative. Well, I did this and I did this and I did this. It sounds very logical and planned, but that is an absolute fallacy. And I think it's true for most people with interesting careers. It isn't that clear, and it is never like a straight arrow going forward. It is more a hodgepodge and a mess that you sort of wander in the desert every now and then. You find the next opportunity, and only in looking back can you make a narrative that sounds logical and coherent, that it's often much messier than that. And so I just did things I enjoyed, and one thing led to the next, and that's more how I describe my career progression.
I think that's an accurate assessment of how most of us end up where we are. And I've had the opportunity, because of the podcast and working with the University of Tennessee now, to interview a lot of physicians, and it's never a linear progression. I've talked with young physicians, and I ask them out of curiosity what their plans are for the future. But from my vantage point, I'm aware that the chances of them actually getting to where they plan to be when they're a medical student or a resident or a young attending are pretty slim, because opportunities like the ones that presented themselves to you come to all of us, and we say yes to things, and then we have very interesting journeys that we never predicted for ourselves.
Well, and a great example of that is the job I'm currently in. I had intended to continue practicing medicine. And in fact, I had in place things in transition that would have made it possible. But I had just changed the hospital I was working at when I started this new position. It was too far away for me to continue working there and do the commissioner role in a global pandemic. There was just no way to do both. I didn't really have a choice. It was either, am I going to be the commissioner or not? And if I was going to be, I had to stop practicing, at least briefly. And then the COVID pandemic just annoyingly wouldn't go away. And so, you know, 6 months passed, a year passed, and before you knew it, it was 2 years before I was even beginning to be able to have enough of a reprieve to think about resuming. And then a long time had passed. And so I've made a career transition at this point, which many freely choose to make, but I made because I had to. It spared me the angst of, you know, deliberating over whether or not I wanted to let go of my clinical identity. It sort of compelled it. And yet here we are here, you know, today, 4.5 years later, and I'm still in this role and I'm not clinically active and will probably continue on a progression as a physician executive of some sort. So, yeah, I mean, you plan life and then life happens and you have to be able to roll with it and be open to the possibilities it affords you.
So a couple of other questions that I'd like to explore with you. Number one is I do have a lot of conversations with physicians who are frustrated by their lack of ability to impact public policy. A lot of physicians, even speaking of the AMA, feel less represented by the AMA than physicians in my generation did, or physicians in my dad's generation. There was a large percentage of physicians who practiced independently who benefited directly from the American Medical Association and other medical associations. Now, with 85% of all physicians being employed by, one could argue, large healthcare organizations, I think there's a level of disengagement or maybe disenfranchisement with organized medicine. How do you see that playing out? And how do you see physicians being able to, as employees of organizations, how can they impact advocacy, especially when not all healthcare organizations make the same decisions that we feel would be best for our specialty or and ultimately for our patients?
Right. So I find it's helpful. I read a lot of history books because I find perspective is invaluable. And sometimes stepping back and putting things in a different context makes an enormous world of difference for how we interpret things. So there's a book more than 20 years ago published called Bowling Alone by a person named Robert Putnam. And in that book, he identified the trend at that time, which is, again, it's more than two decades ago, how people don't just generally join individual membership organizations like they used to. So it's, I believe it's correct, just like you said, that physicians are not belonging to their state and specialty societies at the same rate that they used to. But people are also not joining Rotary clubs, Kiwanis clubs, you know, bowling leagues, things like this. You know, like that's why the book was called Bowling Alone. They're not joining things like that like they used to. And so it's a societal trend. You know, we'd be naive to think that professional associations for physicians are going to somehow buck what is a wide-based societal trend. So one, it's happening all over the place, not just there. The second thing is, it is very difficult. It takes one reason to quit an organization. It takes probably 10 or more to join it, right? So generally, you figure there's, I don't agree with organization A, B, or C for this reason, I'm quitting. That's very easy. It's harder to say they do enough that I want to give them money, right? And people have become, I don't know if it's become, people are transactional ultimately. They have limited time and limited money and limited attention. And so they have to determine what is the value I'm getting for this. And it becomes transactional in a way. And so to the extent it's transactional, these organizations need to demonstrate concrete value to the people who choose to join, where they get real benefits. To the extent it's not transactional, but instead inspirational, we have to be better about telling stories and capturing the imagination and the motivations that drive the people we seek to align with the organization. Those things are difficult. That's business, right? That's what happens in business. So what I would say, and I got tired of arguing with people when I was in leadership at the AMA and doctors coming up and saying, I don't belong, blah, 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 you don't represent me. And I said, yeah, it's okay. Don't feel bad about it. The physicians are all leaders. So follow me on this narrative. Physicians are all leaders. Every single physician out there has a profound impact on patients' lives. In the emergency department, people lived or died if I was good or bad. So we are all leaders. But in a complex, difficult world where success is often incomplete and frustrating, we need leaders of leaders, people who can handle that ambiguity, can handle the disappointments and setbacks, and continue to press forward and try to find ways to make things better. And those are the leaders of leaders, and those are people who join the AMA. And if that doesn't describe you as a physician, don't feel bad about yourself. Not everyone can be a leader of leaders. I'm just happy you're a leader as a physician providing care to patients. Thank you for what you do. And for that subset of physicians who have what it takes to lead the whole profession, they'll join the AMA. And if someday that becomes you, you're welcome. But don't feel bad about it. And yeah. So it's a different way of looking at it. And the AMA, of course, does a whole host of things. It's the largest medical publishing platform for, you know, integrated journals like the JAMA Network. Mm-hmm. In the House of Delegates, it convenes that represents all the Federation of Medicine. and the Code of Medical Ethics, which is the definitive Code of Medical Ethics in law in the United States and a resource around the world, and a number of other things, it still has a profound impact. It does represent the profession, whether everyone agrees with that or not. And it really does work hard to try to do good stuff. And so I think I don't want to argue with people. You're welcome and free to have your perspective. And you shouldn't be compelled to join things you don't feel you want to join. But it does represent physicians the nationwide. And it does do a lot of good stuff to try to support physicians and patients.
Yeah. It is a very complex game, not game in a pejorative sense, but it's a very complex environment right now for the AMA and for all of us, really, the government. But it is interesting. It is interesting to see some of the issues that they've taken on successfully to help medicine over the years and even in the last decade. But it's just kind of interesting as I think physicians feel their voices are somewhat muted by employment agreements and other types of things. They have to be a little more circumspect about what they say and how they say it and make sure that they're careful to indicate who they're representing if it's their personal opinion. And it's just a different, very different environment than when I left residency and went out into practice.
You know, just a few words on that. It is difficult and it can be demoralizing, quite sincerely demoralizing at times. The corporatization of healthcare, I think many of us bemoan that has not been, you know, a good thing in many ways. The incursion, and again, I lectured a business school, right? I mean, I'm wearing a UT Aslam shirt here. I lectured this morning on the structure and function of government in the PEMBA program. So I am a proponent for our American way and capitalism. So I'm not averse to that. However, the incursion of private equity into healthcare, I don't think has necessarily been a good thing. It just seeks to extract more profit from the healthcare enterprise in a scenario where there will never be enough resources to provide all the care needed for all the people who need it. And so now we have a particularly capable group of individuals who are capable of extracting profit from enterprises, extracting profit, which means there is unavoidably less there to provide care for people who need it. Same thing happens in the for-profit sector, just in general. If you have for-profit health systems, for-profit, manufacturers of devices and pharmaceuticals, so it's a real, real challenge. And physicians, I think, have very strong ground to stand on, feeling frustrated that their ability to impact the clinical environment within which they practice and to advocate for themselves and their patients has been markedly constrained over the recent decades. I think that's all very true. And what I would say is we have to continue to focus on what's the blue sky opportunities going forward, and that fighting to get back to yesterday has never worked. It never works trying to put the genie back in the bottle. It's what is the bright, optimistic vision for the future that we all want to be a part of, or that enough of us want to be a part of? And how do we figure out how to get there? And then how do we, in a very pragmatic way, identify those things we control or influence and focus our attentions there, and identify the things we neither control nor influence and put those off to the side and stop hitting our head against the wall? And so I think there's a need to keep our eye on the ball and be focused on what are the positive opportunities, because you know what? Most of the American people don't have sympathy for physicians. Physicians still are educated and compensated well better than the average American. And so if we go looking for sympathy or consolation, we're going to have to look long and hard before we find a lot of it.
I agree. Well, you brought up a couple of interesting points. And what do you see as the areas where we need to be more impactful? What are the biggest health challenges facing your public right now in Kentucky? And how are you trying to tackle some of those areas within the constraints that you talked about?
So this is a great difficulty. It's the same things for a very long time. Smoking rates are too high. Vaping is becoming the substitute for smoking. And while it may have less adverse consequences for pulmonary health, it still is very addictive and still may cause other harms. Obesity and overweight is a very, very challenging problem. It continues to increase the proportion of the population that's obese or overweight, and that's driven by physical inactivity and dietary choices. But we have a society where we have cars and machinery and that make it less necessary than ever before in the human journey to actually have to physically expend effort to get through your day. And we also have a dietary or a food system where highly processed foods that our body that are calorically dense and nutritionally devoid are the easiest and cheapest things to buy. And the hardest and most expensive things to buy, fresh fruit and vegetables and meat and poultry that you have to actually cook and prepare, are things people don't have either the time or the money or the interest to do. So we've designed an environment where the things that make us more overweight and less healthy are the easy things to do. And we need to design an environment where the things that are better for us are the preferred and easier path. And that's very, very difficult. And then, of course, those are the major things population health-wise, but I didn't even touch upon a more specific area, which would be like substance use disorder and overdose, which has been an epidemic and unfortunately has only gotten worse over the years. But it's not the same epidemic it started with. It has transformed. It used to be heroin in the 70s, and then it became prescription drugs in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then we had synthetic fentanyl that really was on the upswing and still is. But now we have polysubstance use. So methamphetamine and cocaine are getting mixed in with these fentanyl and other opioid drugs. And so the drug dealers operate in a commercial system, an illegal commercial system, but a commercial system, and continue to find ways to optimize their product to make it more addictive and unfortunately more harmful at the same time. And it's been very, very difficult to find a way to get ahead of that.
Yeah, so there's so many different crises going on that it sometimes is challenging, I think, for all of us to try to come up with meaningful, effective strategies. I think we've had some success with the opioid prescribing and trying to draw attention to that. And in looking at some of the statistics around that, you can argue that has been one of the more impactful programs from a public health standpoint in the last 10 years. We certainly can't point to anything around obesity, diabetes, and those types of things in the past several decades where we've really reversed the trend. I think that's one that continues, as you said, to be very challenging. And I think it's hard to legislate answers to that because so much of it does come down to economics and what people can afford and what people desire to do. It's a real, but that is going to be an epidemic that I think haunts us for a long time.
It's devilishly difficult and horribly tragic, you know, for the people and the families who are impacted by it.
Yes. So if we take COVID out of your world for the last 4 years, what are you most proud of? What accomplishments or achievements are you most proud of in your tenure as the Commissioner for Public Health?
Well, all the things I'm about to say are in service to the 4.5 million Kentuckians we serve, but I don't do this myself. And in fact, I don't do much of it. It's through many other people. So in the context of a business school, you know, podcast here, I think it's germane to say that it's the team development and the leadership journey that we've been able to go on is a workforce at the Department for Public Health. So one of the things that was clear when I started was that the state workers were undercompensated. They hadn't received but a 1% raise in like the previous 12 years before. Just 1 year, 1%, and no other raises. And it went all the way to 14 years, I think, before they actually got a raise. And there were a lot of vacancies because it's very hard to hire people when you're paying very beneath the market. And so that was one thing. The other thing is that there's not much leadership development invested a lot of times in the public sector. The expectation is you get hired and you do your job. But that's not how high-performing private sector operates. You provide enrichment experiences for your leadership teams and for your employees if you can, so that they skill build and learn how to solve problems and they learn how to work together, right? Well, if you don't do those things, it's no wonder you underperform. So We've read 5 books together as a leadership team. I contracted with one of our public university business schools to do an executive training, 5 half days with the public school. I've taken the local health department leaders and we've gone to state parks and had outside presenters come in to present them with leadership development, how to create psychological safety in the workplace, how to create your narrative and tell your story. I've even just recently spoke, I'm excited about this one. We have one of our public universities has a school of international diplomacy and commerce. And my hope is to have one of those professors talk about conflict resolution. So that how do you find shared common purpose with people that go into the discussion at the beginning with an active disdain for each other? How do you get past that and find commonality and alignment and try to build on that to achieve things together? So these are interesting experiences and they invest in folks. We've also bought access for our broader employee base to Coursera, which is an online on-demand learning platform, so that they can take courses that are of interest to them on demand. We've created a couple curricula for Microsoft Office and for written and verbal communication. So if they complete the whole path, we recognize them in front of the entire workforce for their accomplishment. And we've also started a tuition assistance program for the it's a small number, but for the small number who want to go and pursue a master's degree or a PhD or some other education where they can use that at one of multiple public universities we've contracted with to provide tuition assistance. So we've invested in team and culture and skill building and broken down silos. And I'd share there's a number of key elements I've tried to use. You know, when people make a mistake, that's going to happen. But every member of my leadership team, I think, would tell you if you were to interview them, when a mistake happens and an employee tells you, what is your first response? And the first response is thank you. It's thank you for telling me. The sooner you've let me know, the sooner we can work together to address it. It's not, what the heck were you thinking? How did that happen? Now you've made a mess. Because as soon as you do that, they'll never tell you again.
Right.
So you need to encourage them and say thank you. And then how do you go from that point forward? And be curious, not judgmental, either the Walt Whitman or Ted Lasso quote, depending on where you heard it the first time, right? Is try to seek to understand before seeking to be understood, right? And other phrases about, we have to learn when we interact with folks, with each other, how to acknowledge their opinion and their right to hold it without acquiescing agreement to their opinion. So acknowledge without acquiescing. What I see when people go sideways quickly is instead of acknowledging their opinion and their right to have it, we immediately tell them why they're wrong. And where are you going to go from there? Now you've entered conflict at the very start. If you, on the other hand, say, thank you for telling me how you feel about this, I feel a little bit differently. Here's another way to look at it. Well, you haven't argued with them. You've just said, I see it a little differently, and you can still move forward. But all of these sorts of skills, we're trying to work to learn those things together and train those into not just my senior leadership team, but the next level and then ultimately all of the team, so that everybody within their sphere of authority or their scope of responsibility can then hopefully be empowered to exert some degree of leadership or autonomy, which ultimately is like putting fertilizer on people, because when they feel they have a chance to have impact, even if it's at a relatively small level, they're engaged and interested. And what we found, and this is a long story, Norm, but I'll pause here in a sec. We have done satisfaction surveys for our workforce. And over the last 5 quarters, we find that 93 to 97% of our workforce, when asked, are you satisfied in your role at the Department for Public Health? 93 to 97% agree or strongly agree. And I'd hold that public sector performance up to any private sector. And then when we started asking a net promoter score, would you recommend DPH, Department for Public Health, to a friend or family member as a place to work? Our first ever attempt at this, we scored a 25. A 0 is good, 20 is excellent, 60 is off the charts. And we got a 25 in public sector, which if you Google that, that performs pretty well for a general business. So I think we've made a huge turnaround. I have high confidence that the public health system in Kentucky is stronger than before. The real challenge is now that the public health system is stronger, can we actually improve the health of the public, which is really the ultimate test. And that's the mission we're on over these next few years.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And thank you for sharing all that. I I really enjoyed our conversation. Unfortunately, we've used up our allotted time, but it went by so quickly, and I just really enjoyed having you share with us some of your experiences. It was fantastic.
Well, thank you, Norm. It's been a privilege to be here. Thanks for doing these.
It's really been nice. I look forward to maybe scheduling a time when we can explore some of the other topics that I had hoped we would have gotten to today, but we just ran out of time. But I'm fascinated by a lot of the things that that you shared. And I know that you're still very involved with the University of Tennessee. And you mentioned that you had been teaching there this morning. So we didn't really get to touch on that at all, but this was great.
Sounds good. Well, thanks so much for doing this. And I hope it's helpful to the people who watch it.
Yes, thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed this episode of PEMBA On Demand. I gained many insights during my discussions with Stephen and during the interview. I've included some key links in the show notes for this episode. Off air, Stephen and I discussed more topics regarding his leadership style and the efforts that he's been making to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of his current leadership team. He gave some excellent recommendations for resources and reading materials that he has used with his direct reports to enhance their effectiveness. I'm excited to share those with you in the show notes. PEMBA On Demand podcasts are released bimonthly on Thursdays. Please join us in 2 weeks on July 25th. I will have 4 guests on the podcast to discuss entrepreneurship and some great information for physicians who have innovative ideas that they would like to transfer into a business. We have leaders from 2 programs in Knoxville, the Anderson Center for Entrepreneurship and Techstars of the Future, as well as having 2 entrepreneurs with very innovative healthcare ideas that are trying to create a business model for their products. So please don't forget to join us. In 4 weeks, on August 8th of 2024, my guest on the show will be Dr. Benson Babu. The title of his show is Revolutionizing Healthcare, AI's Role in Modern Medicine. As most of you know, artificial intelligence is having an impact in healthcare currently. We'll be discussing more of the benefits and risks of implementing AI within our healthcare organizations. So please tune in for that as well. That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.